Rule 117, Motion to Quash, Section 1. Time to move to quash. At any time before entering his plea, the accused may move to quash the complaint or information. The complaint in this section does not contemplate a complaint filed before the prosecutor's office or the municipal trial court for preliminary investigation. It refers to number 1, a complaint filed in court involving offenses which could not be prosecuted the official, such as seduction, abduction, acts of lasciviousness, adultery, and concubinage. Or number 2, complaint filed directly with the municipal trial court in cases where preliminary investigation is not required. Or number 3, complaint directly filed to the court by the offended party or peace officer where the accused is arrested without warrant and the inquest prosecutor is absent or unavailable. Motion to quash defined. A motion to quash is a motion requesting that a criminal complaint or information be dismissed on grounds specified by law or rule. Time to move to quash. It is clear from the above rule that the accused may file a motion to quash an information at any time before entering a plea or before arraignment. Thereafter, no motion to quash can be entertained by the court except under the circumstances mentioned in Section 9 of Rule 117, which adopts the omnibus motion rule. However, a motion to quash is not improper even after the accused had been arraigned if the same is grounded on failure to charge an offense, lack of jurisdiction over the offense charge, extinction of the offense or penalty and jeopardy. Right belongs to accused. It is also clear from this section that the right to file a motion to quash belongs only to the accused. There is nothing in the rules which authorizes the court or judge to motu proprio initiate a motion to quash if no such motion was filed by the accused. A motion contemplates an initial action originating from the accused. It is the latter who is in the best position to know on what grounds he will base his objection to the information. Otherwise, if the judge initiates the motion to quash, then he is not only prejudging the case of the prosecution but also takes side with the accused. This would violate the right to a hearing before an independent and impartial tribunal. Thus, the filing of a motion to quash is a right that belongs to the accused who may waive it by inaction and not an authority for the court to assume. Section 2. Form and Contents. The motion to quash shall be in writing signed by the accused or his counsel and shall distinctly specify its factual and legal grounds. The court shall consider no ground other than those stated in the motion except lack of jurisdiction over the offense charge. Necessity of motion. The rule clearly implies the requirement of filing a motion by the accused even if the ground asserted is premised on lack of jurisdiction over the offense charge. Besides, lack of jurisdiction should be evident from the face of the information or complaint to warrant a dismissal thereof. The motion must be signed by the accused or his counsel. Hearing on the motion. The motion to quash must be set for hearing, except for motions which the court may act upon without prejudicing the right of the adverse party. Every written motion shall be set for hearing by the applicant. Grounds to be considered. The only grounds which the court may consider in resolving a motion to quash an information or complaint are number 1, those grounds stated in the motion, and number 2, the ground of lack of jurisdiction over the offense charge, whether or not mentioned in the motion. Section 2 ordains that the court is prescribed from considering any ground other than those stated in the motion, which should be specified distinctly therein. Other than that, grounds which have not been sharply pleaded in the motion cannot be taken cognizance of by the court, even if at the time of the filing thereof, it may be properly invoked by the accused. Such prescription on considerations of other grounds than those specially pleaded in the motion to quash is premised on the rationale that the right to these defenses are waivable on the part of the accused and that by claiming to waive said right, he is deemed to have desired these matters to be litigated upon in a full-blown trial. However, although a motion to quash should be resolved solely on the allegations contained in the information, additional facts admitted or not denied by the prosecution in the hearing of the motion may be invoked to support the quashal of the information. Section 3. Grounds. The accused may move to quash the complaint or information on any of the following grounds. Letter A. that the facts charged do not constitute an offense. Letter B, that the court trying the case has no jurisdiction over the offense charged. Letter C, that the court trying the case has no jurisdiction over the person of the accused. Letter D, that the officer who filed the information had no authority to do so. Letter E, that it does not conform substantially to the prescribed form. Letter F, that more than one offense is charged except when a single punishment for various offenses is prescribed by law. Letter G, that the criminal action or liability has been extinguished. Letter H, that it contains averments which, if true, would constitute a legal excuse or justification. And letter I, that the accused has been previously convicted or acquitted of the offense charge, or the case against him was dismissed or otherwise terminated without his express consent. The requisites of double jeopardy as a ground for a motion to quash are clarified by deleting the phrase "or in jeopardy of being convicted" from subparagraph I of this section and inserting the phrase "or the case against him was dismissed or otherwise terminated without his consent" as provided in section 7 of this rule. Letter A, no offense charge. The accused may move to quash the complaint or information on the ground that the facts charged do not constitute an offense. Test of no offense charge. The fundamental test in reflecting on the viability of a motion to quash under this particular ground is whether or not the facts asseverated, if hypothetically admitted, would establish the essential elements of the crime defined in law. If the facts would not so establish, then the complaint or information should be dismissed. As a general proposition, a motion to quash on the ground that the allegations of the information do not constitute the offense charge, or any offense for that matter, should be resolved on the basis alone of said allegations, whose truth and veracity are hypothetically admitted. In this examination, matters aliunde are not considered. In other words, a resolution of the challenge to the validity of the criminal proceeding on such ground should be limited to an inquiry whether the facts alleged in the information, if hypothetically admitted, constitute the elements of an offense punishable under the law. Letter B, lack of jurisdiction over the offense. The accused may move to quash the complaint or information on the ground that the court trying the case has no jurisdiction over the offense charge. The rule is well settled that questions relating to want or lack of jurisdiction may be raised at any stage of the proceeding. This is the sole ground that the trial court may consider even if not alleged in the motion to quash. The court on its own motion dismiss the complaint or information on the ground that it has no jurisdiction over the offense charge. Requisites of jurisdiction over the offense charge. A court has jurisdiction over the offense charge if the following requisites concur. Letter E, the offense charge is one which the court is by law conferred to take cognizance of, and letter B, the offense must have been committed within its territorial jurisdiction. Jurisdiction over the offense. How acquired? Jurisdiction over the offense is conferred by law. By the filing of the complaint or information, the jurisdiction of the court thereof is invoked or called into activity, and it is this that the court acquires jurisdiction over the offense charge. Territorial jurisdiction over the offense. It is a fundamental rule that for jurisdiction to be acquired by courts in criminal cases, the offense should have been committed or any one of its essential ingredients took place within the territorial jurisdiction of the court. Thus, it cannot take jurisdiction over a person charged with an offense allegedly committed outside of the limited territory. It is thus a rule that in all criminal prosecutions, the action shall be instituted and tried in the court of the municipality or territory wherein the offense was committed or where any one of the essential ingredients thereof took place. The specific crime charge must in fact have been committed at a place within the jurisdiction of the court. Venue in criminal cases is jurisdictional, being an essential element of jurisdiction. Stated differently, the place of the commission of the offense is an element of criminal jurisdiction. Jurisdiction over the offense how determined? The jurisdiction of a court over the offense charge is determined by the allegations in the complaint or information, and once it is so shown, the court may validly take cognizance of the case. However, if the evidence adduced during the trial shows that the offense was committed somewhere else, the court should dismiss the action for want of jurisdiction. The jurisdiction of the court over the offense charge is not determined by what may be meted out to the offender after trial, or even by the result of the evidence that would be presented during the trial, but by the extent of the penalty which the law imposes together with other legal obligations on the basis of the facts as recited in the complaint or information constitutive of the offense charge. C. Lack of jurisdiction over the person of the accused. The accused may move to quash the complaint or information on the ground that the court trying the case has no jurisdiction over the person of the accused. Jurisdiction over the accused, how acquired? Jurisdiction over the accused is acquired by his lawful arrest or by his voluntary submission to the jurisdiction of the court. When the accused is unlawfully arrested but he entered a plea on arraignment, without invoking his right to question any irregularity which might have accompanied his arrest, he voluntarily submitted himself to the jurisdiction of the court and the judicial process. Any objection, defect, or irregularity attending his arrest should be made before he enters his plea. As a general rule, one who seeks an affirmative relief from the court is deemed to have submitted to the jurisdiction of the court. There is, however, an exception to the rule that filing pleadings or motions seeking affirmative relief constitutes voluntary appearance and the consequent submission of one's person to the jurisdiction of the court. This is in case of motions whose prayer is precisely for the avoidance of the jurisdiction of the court, which only leads to a special appearance. These are, number one, motions to quash a complaint on the ground of lack of jurisdiction over the person of the accused, and number two, motion to quash a warrant of arrest. Effect of raising grounds other than lack of jurisdiction over the accused. The rule is that if the accused objects to the jurisdiction of the court over his person, he may move to quash the information, but only on that ground. If the accused raises other grounds in the motion to quash, he is deemed to have waived that objection and to have submitted his person to the jurisdiction of the court. Stated differently, where the appearance is by a motion for the purpose of objecting to the jurisdiction of the court over the person, it must be for the sole and separate purpose of objecting to said jurisdiction. If the appearance is for any other purpose, the accused is deemed to have submitted himself to the jurisdiction of the court. Such an appearance gives the court jurisdiction over the person. Letter D. Lack of authority of the officer who filed the information. The accused may move to quash the information on the ground that the officer who filed the information had no authority to do so. This subparagraph of Section 3 does not on its face include a complaint filed directly to the municipal trial court by the offended party peace officer or other officer charged with the enforcement of the law violated, as well as a complaint filed directly to the regional trial court in case of absence or unavailability of an inquest prosecutor. Nevertheless, it is believed that where the complaint is filed in court by a person other than the offended party or by an improper officer, the accused may move to quash the complaint on the ground that the person or officer filing the complaint has no personality or authority to do so. Information by whom filed. The information may be filed by the following officers. Number 1, the provincial or city prosecutors and their assistants. Number 2, the chief state prosecutor. Number 3, the ombudsman or his deputies. Number 4, national and regional state prosecutors. Number 5, the Commission on Elections in Election Offenses. Number 6, special counsels designated by the Secretary of Justice under Section 1686 of the Revised Administrative Code as amended have the authority to sign and file the information. Lack of authority not waivable. An information required to be filed by a prosecuting officer cannot be filed by another. It must be exhibited or presented by the prosecuting attorney or someone authorized by law. If not, the court does not acquire jurisdiction. A valid information signed by a competent officer confers jurisdiction on the court over the subject matter of the accusation. In consonance with this view, an infirmity in the information, such as lack of authority of the officer signing it, cannot be cured by silence, acquiescence, or even by express consent. The court does not acquire jurisdiction over the case because there is a defect in the information. Thus, in a case, the accused was apprehended in Mabalacat, Pampanga for illegal possession of firearms and was brought to Angeles City where the headquarters of the arresting officers was located. The city prosecutor of Angeles City filed an information in the Regional Trial Court of Angeles City. The High Court invalidated the information filed by the city prosecutor because he had no territorial jurisdiction as the offense was committed in Mabalacat, Pampanga, and his territorial jurisdiction was only in Angeles City. It was held that an information, when required by law to be filed by a public prosecuting officer, cannot be filed by another. Otherwise, the court does not acquire jurisdiction. So also where the information for violation of SSS laws was filed by a state prosecutor without the prior approval of the city prosecutor, it was held that in the absence of a directive from the Secretary of Justice designating the state prosecutor as special prosecutor for SSS cases, or a prior written approval of the information by the provincial or city prosecutor, the information was filed by an officer without authority to file the same. This infirmity in the information constitutes a jurisdictional defect that cannot be cured. Also, in a case, although the resolution finding probable cause was validly made as it bore the approval of one of the designated review prosecutors, but where there is no showing that the information was approved either by the city prosecutor of Makati or any of the OCP Makati's division chiefs or review prosecutors who were given authority under OCP Makati Office Order Number 32 to approve or act on any resolution, issuance, order, action, and any information recommended by any prosecutor for approval. It was held that the information suffers from an incurable infirmity, that is, that the officer who filed the same before the RTC had no authority to do so. Letter E, failure to conform to prescribed form. The accused may move to quash the complaint or information on the ground that it does not conform substantially to the prescribed form. The formal and substantial requirements of a complaint or information are provided for in Section 3 to 13 of Rule 110. Thus, if the information failed to allege with certainty the time of the commission of the offense, the remedy of the accused is to move either for a bill of particulars or for the quashal of the information on the ground that it does not conform substantially to the prescribed form. Waiver of formal objections. The accused's failure to invoke a formal defect in the information through a motion to quash is deemed to be a waiver of such objection, and he cannot later be heard to seek affirmative relief on that ground. Moreover, objections as to matters of form or substance in the information cannot be made for the first time on appeal. Letter F, duplicity of offense. The accused may move to quash the complaint or information on the ground that more than one offense is charged, except when a single punishment for various offenses is prescribed by law. Information must charge one offense. The rule requires that the complaint or information must charge but one offense, except in complex crimes where the law prescribes a single punishment for various offenses. The exception to the rule is when the law prescribes a single punishment for various offenses. Such offenses constitute a complex crime, which must be alleged in the complaint or information. In a complex crime, although two or more crimes are actually committed, they constitute only one crime in the eyes of the law, as in the conscience of the offender, because the offender has only one criminal intent. The exception effectively prevents splitting of the criminal action by filing several complaints or information against the accused for one complex crime. Also, where the allegations of the acts imputed to the accused are only to show the modes of the commission of the crime, or are merely different counts specifying the acts of perpetration of the same crime, or when the other offense is only an ingredient or essential element of the real offense charge, there is no duplicity. Letter G, extinction of criminal action or liability. The accused may move to quash the complaint or information on the ground that the criminal action or liability has been extinguished. Section 3G, Rule 117. Jurisprudence considers prescription of a crime or offense as a loss or waiver by the state of its right to prosecution, an act prohibited and punished by law. The basic substantive laws on prescription of offenses are Articles 90 and 91 of the Revised Penal Code for offenses punishable thereunder, and Act Number 3326 as amended for those penalized by special laws. Thus, where it is shown that the criminal liability was already extinguished by prescription, the trial court committed grave abuse of discretion in not sustaining the motion to quash the information. grounds for extinction of criminal liability. Criminal liability is totally extinguished, number one, by the death of the convict, as to the personal penalties, as to the pecuniary penalties, liabilities therefore is extinguished only when the death of the offender occurs before final judgment. Number two, by service of the sentence, by amnesty, number three, which completely extinguished the penalty and all its effects. Number four, by absolute pardon. Number five, by prescription of the crime. Number six, by prescription of the penalty. Number seven, by the marriage of the offended woman as provided in Article 344 of the Revised Penal Code, Article 89, Revised Penal Code. Prescription of crimes. The applicable provisions of law on prescription of offenses are found in Article 90 and 91 of the Revised Penal Code for offenses punishable thereunder and Act Number 3326 for those penalized by special laws and municipal ordinances. Under the Revised Penal Code, crimes punishable by death, reclusion perpetua, or reclusion temporal shall prescribe in 20 years. Crimes punishable by other afflictive penalties shall prescribe in 15 years. Those punishable by a correctional penalty shall prescribe in 10 years. With the exception of those punishable by arrest de mayor, which shall prescribe in 5 years. The crime of libel or other similar offenses shall prescribe in 1 year. The offenses of oral defamation and slander by deed shall prescribe in 6 months. Light offenses prescribe in 2 months. When the penalty fixed by law is a compound one, the highest penalty shall be made the basis of the application of the rules contained in the first, second, and third paragraph of this article, Article 90, Revised Penal Code. Under Act Number 3326, violations penalized by special acts shall, unless otherwise provided in such acts, prescribe in accordance with the following rules. Letter A, after a year for offenses punished only by a fine or by imprisonment for not more than 1 month or both. Letter B, after 4 years for those punished by imprisonment for more than 1 month but less than 2 years. Letter C, after 8 years for those punished by imprisonment for 2 years or more, but not less than 6 years. Letter D, after 12 years for any other offense punished by imprisonment for 6 years or more, except the crime of treason, which shall prescribe after 20 years. Provided, however, that all offenses against any law or part of law administered by the Bureau of Internal Revenue shall prescribe after 5 years. Letter E, violations penalized by municipal ordinances shall prescribe after 2 years. Interruption of prescription, exception. The institution of the criminal action shall interrupt the running of the period of prescription of the offense charge, unless otherwise provided in special laws. Thus, the filing of the complaint with the prosecutor's office or with his deputies, such as the ombudsman Visayas, suspends the running of the prescriptive period. The prescriptive period remains tolled from the time the complaint is filed with the office of the prosecutor until such time that respondent is either convicted or acquitted by the proper court. It has been held under the old rule that the filing of the complaint with the municipal court, even if it be merely for purposes of preliminary examination or investigation, interrupts the period of prescription of the criminal responsibility, even if the court where the complaint or information is filed cannot try the case on the merits. Exception to the rule. The exception to this rule is when a special law provides otherwise, Section 1, Rule 110, under Act Number 3326 as amended, entitled an Act to Establish Periods of Prescription for Violations Penalized by Special Acts and Municipal Ordinances, and to provide when prescription shall begin to run. The prescriptive periods for offenses punishable by special laws and municipal ordinances are not interrupted by the institution of the criminal action before the office of the prosecutor. In interpreting the provision of Section 2 of the Act, the Supreme Court said that the proceedings referred to therein are judicial proceedings. Thus, in a case involving violation of a municipal ordinance, it was held that the prescriptive period was not interrupted by the filing of the complaint with the office of the provincial prosecutor, as such did not constitute a judicial proceeding. What could have told the prescriptive period there was only the filing of the information in the proper court. In another case, it was held that since the law alleged to have been violated, paragraphs E and G of Section 3RA number 3019 as amended is a special law. The applicable rule in the computation of the prescriptive period is Section 2 of Act Number 3326 as amended. factors of prescription. In resolving the issue of prescription of the offense charge, the following should be considered. Number one, the period of prescription for the offense charge. Number two, the time the period of prescription starts to run. And number three, the time the prescription period was interrupted. Pardon in private crimes. The pardon to justify the dismissal of the complaint should be made prior to and not after the institution of the criminal action, which in turn is cited in People versus Villorente 210 CRA 647. Accordingly, the prosecution of the case continues even if the offended party pardons the offender after the case has been instituted. An affidavit of desistance by itself, even when construed as a pardon in the so-called private crimes, is not a ground for the dismissal of the criminal case once the action has been instituted. The affidavit nevertheless may possibly constitute evidence whose weight or probative value, like any other piece of evidence, would be up to the court for proper evaluation. Letter H. Information containing legal excuse or justification. The accused may move to quash the complaint or information on the ground that it contains averments which, if true, would constitute a legal excuse or justification. Section 3H, Rule 117. This contemplates a situation where the complaint or information contains allegations which, if proved to be true, constitute justifying or exempting circumstances under Article 11 and 12 respectively of the Revised Penal Code or other absolutory causes. Justifying circumstances. The following do not incur any criminal liability. Number one, anyone who acts in defense of his person or rights, provided that the following circumstances concur. First, unlawful aggression. Second, reasonable necessity of the means employed to prevent or repel it. Third, lack of sufficient provocation on the part of the person defending himself. Number two, anyone who acts in defense of the person or rights of his spouse, ascendants, descendants, or legitimate natural or adopted brothers or sisters, or of his relatives by affinity in the same degrees and those by consanguinity within the fourth civil degree, provided that the first and second requisites prescribed in the next proceeding circumstance are present, and the further requisite in case the provocation was given by the person attacked, that the one making defense had no part therein. Number three, anyone who acts in defense of the person or rights of a stranger, provided that the first and second requisites mentioned in the first circumstance of this article are present, and that the person defending be not included, be not induced by revenge, resentment, or other evil motive. Number four, any person who, in order to avoid an evil or injury, does an act which causes damage to another, provided that the following requisites are present. First, that the evil sought to be avoided actually exists. Second, that the injury feared be greater than that done to avoid it. Third, that there be no other practical and less harmful means of preventing it. Number five, any person who acts in the fulfillment of a duty or in the lawful exercise of a right or office. Number six, any person who acts in obedience to an order issued by a superior for some lawful purpose. Exempting circumstances. The following are exempt from criminal liability. Number one, an imbecile or an insane person, unless the latter has acted during a lucid interval, when the imbecile or an insane person has committed an act which the law defines as a felony or delito, the court shall order his confinement in one of the hospitals or asylums established for persons thus afflicted, which he shall not be permitted to leave without first obtaining the permission of the same court. Number two, a person under 15 years of age, however, the child shall be subjected to an intervention program under Section 20 of the Acts establishing a comprehensive juvenile justice and welfare system. Number three, a person over 15 years of age and under 18, unless he has acted with discernment, in which case such child shall be subjected to the appropriate proceedings in accordance with the provisions of the Act establishing a comprehensive juvenile justice and welfare system. Number four, any person who, while performing a lawful act with due care, causes an injury by mere accident without fault or intention of causing it. Number five, any person who acts under the compulsion of an irresistible force. Number six, any person who acts under the impulse of an uncontrollable fear of an equal or greater injury. Number seven, any person who fails to perform an act required by law when prevented by some lawful or insuperable cause. Persons exempt from criminal liability. No criminal but only civil liability shall result from the commission of the crime of theft, swindling, or malicious mischief committed or caused mutually by the following persons. Number one, spouses, ascendants, and descendants or relatives by affinity in the same line. Number two, the widowed spouse with respect to the property which belonged to the deceased spouse before the same shall have passed into the possession of another. And number three, brothers and sisters and brothers-in-law and sisters-in-law if living together. The exemption established by this article shall not be applicable to strangers participating in the commission of the crime. I, double jeopardy. The accused may move to quash the complaint or information on the ground that the accused has been previously convicted or acquitted of the offense charge, or the case against him was dismissed or otherwise terminated without his express consent. For a detailed discussion of double jeopardy, see annotations under Section 7 hereof. Objections not grounds to quash. The enumeration of the grounds for a motion to quash the complaint or information under Section 3 of this rule is exclusive in character. No other ground to quash the complaint or information shall be entertained. Accordingly, the following do not constitute grounds to quash in the complaint or information, viz., failure to furnish resolution. The failure of the prosecution to furnish copy of the resolution in the preliminary investigation to the respondent is not a ground to quash an information. The failure to furnish the respondent with a copy of an adverse resolution does not affect the validity of an information thereafter filed, even if a copy of the resolution upon which the information is based was not served upon the respondent. Lack of probable cause. Lack of probable cause is not one of the grounds for a motion to quash under Rule 117, Section 3 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure. A motion to quash should be based on a defect in the information which is evident on its face. The guilt or innocence of the accused's degree of participation and the mitigating, aggravating, or alternative circumstances which should be appreciated are properly the subject of trial on the merits rather than a motion to quash. However, the court may motu proprio dismiss the complaint or information if, after personally evaluating the resolution of the prosecutor and its supporting evidence within 10 days from the filing thereof, it finds that the evidence on record clearly fails to establish probable cause. Lack of preliminary investigation. The absence of preliminary investigation is not a ground for a motion to quash, not only because it is not stated by the rule as one of the grounds, but also because lack of preliminary investigation neither impair the validity of the information nor render it defective nor affect the jurisdiction of the court over the case. The remedy of the accused is to ask for a preliminary investigation. Pendency of another charge. Unlike pendency of another action between the same parties for the same cause, which is a ground for a motion to dismiss in civil cases, the pendency of another charge for the same offense is not a ground for a motion to quash under this section. Thus, the accused cannot invoke double jeopardy, a criminal case which is yet pending in another court because it has not yet resulted in conviction, acquittal, or dismissal. Section 4, Amendment of Complaint or Information. If the motion to quash is based on an alleged defect of the complaint or information which can be cured by amendment, the court shall order that an amendment be made. If it is based on the ground that the facts charged do not constitute an offense, the prosecution shall be given by the court an opportunity to correct the defect by amendment. The motion shall be granted if the prosecution fails to make the amendment or the complaint or information still suffers from the same defect despite the amendment. Amendment of complaint or information. If a motion to quash is filed against the complaint or information, which can be cured by amendment, the trial court should deny the motion and instead order the public prosecutor to amend the complaint or information by correcting the alleged defect in the information. It is only when the prosecutor failed to make the necessary amendment that the case should be dismissed. The court issue an order granting the motion to quash the information and such order becomes final and executory. There is nothing more to amend. If it is based on the ground that the facts charged do not constitute an offense, the prosecution shall be given by the court an opportunity to correct the defect by amendment. The court need not issue an order denying the motion to quash. It is enough that it issue an order directing the amendment of the complaint or information. If the prosecution fails to make the amendment or the complaint or information still suffers from the same defect, despite the amendment, the motion shall be granted and the court should issue an order quashing the complaint or information and ordering the discharge of the accused if under custody unless he is also in custody for another charge. Remedy against denial of the motion. The consistent doctrine is that from a denial of a motion to quash, the appropriate remedy is not certiorari, but to go to trial without prejudice to reiterating the special defenses involved in said motion, and if after trial on the merits an adverse decision is rendered, to appeal therefrom in the manner authorized by law. Certiorari prohibition or mandamus do not lie to review an order denying a motion to quash. Hence, certiorari is not the proper remedy where a motion to quash an information is denied. This is impelled by the fact that a denial of a motion to quash is an interlocutory procedural aspect which cannot be appealed, nor can it be the subject of a petition for certiorari. Thus, the general rule is that a denial of a motion to dismiss or to quash in criminal cases is interlocutory and cannot be the subject of an appeal or of a special civil action for certiorari. Nevertheless, the Supreme Court has allowed a special civil action for certiorari where a lower court has acted without or in excess of jurisdiction or with grave abuse of discretion in denying a motion to dismiss, or in the interest of more enlightened and substantial justice. In the exceptional case where such denial may be the subject of a special civil action for certiorari, a motion for reconsideration must first be filed to give the trial court an opportunity to correct its error. In Tano v. Salvador, the High Court, while holding that certiorari will not lie from a denial of a motion to quash, nevertheless recognized that there may be cases where there are special circumstances clearly demonstrating the inadequacy of an appeal. In such cases, the accused may resort to the appellate court to raise the issue decided against him. An interlocutory order may be assailed by certiorari or prohibition only when it is shown that the court acted without or in excess of jurisdiction or with grave abuse of discretion. Section 5. Effect of sustaining the motion to quash. If the motion to quash is sustained, the court may order that another complaint or information be filed except as provided in Section 6 of this rule. If the order is made, the accused, if in custody, shall not be discharged unless admitted to bail. If no order is made, or if having been made, no new information is filed within the time specified in the order or within such further time as the court may allow for good cause, the accused, if in custody, shall be discharged unless he is also in custody for another charge. Section 6. Order sustaining the motion to quash, not a bar to another prosecution. Exception. An order sustaining the motion to quash is not a bar to another prosecution for the same offense unless the motion was based on the ground specified in Section 3, paragraph G and I of this rule. Effect of quashing the complaint or information. If the motion to quash is sustained, the court may order that another complaint or information be filed except when it is grounded on double jeopardy or extinction of criminal liability. If the order is made, the accused, if in custody, shall not be discharged unless admitted to bail. If no order is made for the filing of a new complaint or information, or if having been made, no new complaint or information is filed within the time specified in the order or within such further time as the court may allow for good cause, the accused, if in custody, shall be discharged unless he is also in custody for another charge. Otherwise stated, where the motion to quash is sustained on grounds other than those stated in Section 6, the trial court has discretion to order the filing of another information within a specified period, which is extendable to such further time as the court may allow for good cause. The order to file another information, if determined to be warranted under the circumstances of the case, must be contained in the same order granting the motion to quash. If the order sustaining the motion to quash does not order the filing of another information and said order becomes final and executory, the court may no longer direct the filing of another information. Quash shall not a bar to another prosecution. The order quashing the complaint or information is not a bar to another prosecution for the same offense unless the quashal of the complaint or information is based on the grounds of double jeopardy or extinction of the criminal action or liability. Thus, the order sustaining a motion to quash on the ground that facts charged do not constitute an offense is not a bar to another prosecution for the same offense. Where the quashal is based on double jeopardy or extinction, the court cannot order that another complaint or information be filed. Section 7. Former conviction or acquittal. Double jeopardy. When an accused has been convicted or acquitted, or the case against him dismissed or otherwise terminated without his express consent by a court of competent jurisdiction, upon valid complaint or information or other formal charge sufficient in form and substance to sustain a conviction, and after the accused had pleaded to the charge, the conviction or acquittal of the accused or the dismissal of the case shall be a bar to another prosecution for the offense charge or for any attempt to commit the same or frustration thereof or for any offense which necessarily includes or is necessarily included in the offense charge in the former complaint or information. However, the conviction of the accused shall not be a bar to another prosecution for an offense which necessarily includes the offense charge in the former complaint or information under any of the following instances. Letter A, the graver offense developed due to supervening facts arising from the same act or omission constituting the former charge. Letter B, the facts constituting the graver charge became known or were discovered only after a plea was entered in the former complaint or information. Or letter C, the plea of guilty to the lesser offense was made without the consent of the prosecutor and of the offended party except as provided in Section 1F of Rule 116. In any of the foregoing cases where the accused satisfies or serves in whole or in part the judgment, he shall be credited with the same in the event of conviction for the graver offense. The second exception to the rule on double jeopardy was clarified under subparagraph B of this section. It remedies the anomalous situation in People v. City of Manila. Concept of double jeopardy. The Constitution provides that no person shall be twice put in jeopardy for the same offense. If an act is punished by a law and an ordinance convicted or acquittal under either shall constitute a bar to another prosecution for the same act. When a person is charged with an offense and the case is terminated either by acquittal or conviction or in any other manner without the consent of the accused, the latter cannot again be charged with the same or identical offense. This is double jeopardy. It bears stressing that where acquittal is concerned, the rules do not distinguish whether it occurs at the level of the trial court or on appeal from a judgment of conviction. This firmly establishes the finality of acquittal rule in this jurisdiction. Therefore, as mandated by the Constitution, statutes, and cognate jurisprudence, an acquittal is final and unappealable on the ground of double jeopardy, whether it happens at the trial court level or before the appellate court. An appeal or a petition for review of a judgment of acquittal under Rule 45 is barred by the rule of double jeopardy. The rule on double jeopardy prohibits the state from appealing or filing a petition for review of a judgment of acquittal that was based on the merits of the case. Thus, a judgment of acquittal is immediately final and executory, and the prosecution cannot appeal the acquittal because of the constitutional prohibition against double jeopardy. Requisites of double jeopardy. For double jeopardy to exist, the following requisites must be established. Letter A, a first jeopardy must have attached prior to the second. Number 2, for the first jeopardy must have terminated. And number 3, the second jeopardy must be for the same offense as the first. Or the second offense includes or is necessarily included in the offense charge in the first information or is an attempt to commit the same or is a frustration thereof. For the first jeopardy to attach, the following elements must concur. Number 1, the accused individual is charged under a complaint or an information sufficient in form and substance to sustain his conviction. Number 2, the court has jurisdiction. Number 3, the accused had been arraigned and had pleaded. And number 4, he is convicted or acquitted or the case was dismissed or otherwise terminated without his express consent. Test of double jeopardy. There are two recognized tests in determining the existence of double jeopardy, namely number 1, the same offense test, and number 2, the same evidence test. The same offense test, this test is provided for in Section 7, Rule 117. The conviction or acquittal of the accused or the dismissal of the case shall be a bar to another prosecution for the offense charge or for any attempt to commit the same or frustration thereof or for any offense which necessarily includes or is necessarily included in the offense charge in the former complaint or information. This is also known as the identity rule. To entitle the accused to the benefit of double jeopardy, the offenses charged in the two prosecutions must be for the same offense. The term same offense was held to mean identical offense or any attempt to commit the same or frustration thereof or any offense charge which necessarily includes or is included in the offense charge in the former complaint or information. The same evidence test, the test for determining whether or not a prosecution for one crime constitutes an obstacle to a subsequent action for another distinct crime upon the same facts, is to inquire whether the facts alleged in the second information, if proven, would have been sufficient to support the former information, of which the accused may have been acquitted or convicted. The gist of the question is whether or not the same evidence supports that two actions. In other words, the test is to inquire whether the two offenses are in substance precisely the same or of the same nature or of the same species, so that the evidence which proves the one would prove the other, or if this is not the case, then the one crime must be an ingredient of the other. Negative test. Other negative tests have also been laid down, viz. Number 1, a single act may be an offense against two statutes, and if each statute requires proof of an additional fact which the other does not, then it does not exempt the accused from prosecution or conviction under the other. Number 2, if the evidence required to convict under the first indictment would not be sufficient to convict under the second indictment, but proof of an additional fact would be necessary to constitute the offense charged in the second, the former conviction or acquittal is not a bar. Number 3, unless the two offenses charged are the same in law and in fact, they are not the same offense. Effect of double jeopardy. When double jeopardy exists, the conviction or acquittal of the accused or the dismissal of the case shall be a bar to another prosecution for the offense charge or for any attempt to commit the same or frustration thereof or for any offense which necessarily includes or is necessarily included in the offense charge in the former complaint or information. When conviction, not a bar to another prosecution. By way of exception to the rule against double jeopardy, the conviction of the accused shall not be a bar to another prosecution for an offense which necessarily includes the offense charge in the former complaint or information under any of the following instances. Letter A, supervening facts. The graver offense developed due to supervening facts arising from the same act or omission constituting the former charge. The rule of identity does not apply when the second offense was not in existence at the time of the first prosecution, for the simple reason that in such case there is no possibility for the accused during the first prosecution to be convicted for an offense that was then in existence. Stated differently, if after the first prosecution a new fact supervenes on which accused may be held liable, resulting in altering the character of the crime and giving rise to a new and distinct offense, the accused cannot be said to be in second jeopardy if indicted for the new offense. Thus, where the accused was charged with physical injuries and after conviction the injuries dies, the charge of homicide against the same accused does not put him in jeopardy. Also, where the accused was charged of slight physical injuries only because according to the certification of the attending physician, the injuries suffered by the offended party would require medical attendance from 5 to 9 days, only barring complications, and the said case was dismissed, a subsequent charge of serious physical injury is not barred by double jeopardy where the alleged deformity in the face of the victim became apparent later. Let there be newly discovered facts. The facts constituting the graver charge became known or were discovered only after a plea was entered in the former complaint or information. Letter C, improper plea of guilty to a lesser offense. The plea of guilty to the lesser offense was made without the consent of the prosecutor and of the offended party, except when the private offended party failed to appear in the arraignment despite due notice. In any of the foregoing cases where the accused satisfies or serves in whole or in part the judgment, he shall be credited with the same in the event of conviction for the graver offense. The eventual absorption of the penalty imposed in the former prosecution for the lesser offense is intended to avoid injustice so that the accused shall only serve the sentence imposed for the greater offense. No double jeopardy instances. There is no double jeopardy in the following cases. When the accused appeals from the sentence, it is well settled that when an accused appeals from the sentence of the trial court, he waived the constitutional safeguard against double jeopardy and throws the whole case open to the review of the appellate court, which is then called to render a judgment as the law and justice dictate. When the civil aspect is appealed, where what was elevated to the appellate court was the civil aspect of the criminal case, and the appellate court did not modify the judgment of acquittal, nor did it order the filing of a second criminal case against the accused for the same offense, there is no second jeopardy to speak of. Either the offended party or the accused may appeal the civil aspect of the judgment despite the acquittal of the accused, when the action is dismissed with the express consent of the accused. The dismissal of a criminal case resulting in acquittal made with the express consent of the accused or upon his own motion will not place the accused in double jeopardy. except when number one, the dismissal is based on insufficiency of evidence, or number two, the case is dismissed for violation of the accused's right to speedy trial. Thus, double jeopardy may attach when the proceedings have been prolonged unreasonably in violation of the accused's right to speedy trial. When the judgment is void, the general rule is that where the assailed judgment is void, no double jeopardy results from the refiling of the criminal case. A void judgment is, in legal effect, no judgment at all. By it, no rights are divested. Through it, no rights can be attained. Being worthless, all proceedings founded upon it are equally worthless. It neither binds nor bars anyone. All acts performed under it and all claims flowing out of it are void. An acquittal rendered in grave abuse of discretion amounting to lack or excess of jurisdiction does not really acquit and therefore does not terminate the case, as there can be no double jeopardy based on a void in the indictment. Likewise, a judgment rendered by the trial court which was based on a void plea bargaining is also void ab initio and cannot be considered to have attained finality for the simple reason that a void judgment has no legality from its inception. As such, double jeopardy will not lie. Where the prosecution is denied due process, it is settled doctrine that double jeopardy cannot be invoked against the Supreme Court's setting aside of the trial court's judgment of acquittal where the prosecution, which represents the sovereign people in criminal cases, is denied due process. The remand of the criminal case for further hearing and our trial before the lower courts amounts merely to a continuation of the first jeopardy and does not expose the accused to a second jeopardy. In only one case has the Supreme Court categorically declared a mistrial, and that is the case of Galman v. Sandigan Bayan, where it nullified the judgment of acquittal of the Sandigan Bayan in criminal case number 10010 and 10011, entitled People of the Philippines v. General Luther Custodio et al. There it was shown that evidence was suppressed in order to justify the acquittal of the accused. It was held that the secret Malacanang conference at which the authoritarian president called together the presiding judge of the Sandigan Bayan, Manuel Pamaran, and Tanod Bayan Bernardo Fernandez, and the entire prosecution panel headed by Deputy Tanod Bayan Manuel Herrera, and told them how to handle and rig more and more the trial and the close monitoring of the entire proceeding to assure the predetermined ignominious final outcome are without parallel and precedent in our annals of jurisprudence. When the trial court commits grave abuse of discretion, when the trial court commits grave abuse of discretion in dismissing a criminal case by granting the accused demurrer to evidence, there is no double jeopardy. An acquittal rendered in grave abuse of discretion amounting to lack of or excess of jurisdiction does not really acquit and therefore does not terminate the case. When the court has had no jurisdiction, there can be no double jeopardy where the accused entered a plea in a court that had no jurisdiction. Thus, it was held in a case that the filing of the information in the Sandigan Bayan did not put accused in double jeopardy, even though they had already pleaded not guilty to the information earlier filed in the RTC. The first jeopardy never attached in the first place. The RTC, not being a court of competent jurisdiction, the remedy of accused, therefore, was not to move for the quashal of the information pending in the Sandigan Bayan on the ground of double jeopardy. Their remedy was to move for the quashal of the information pending in the RTC on the ground of lack of jurisdiction. This is in Binay v. Sandigan Bayan. When the information is defective, jeopardy does not attach where an accused pleads guilty to a defective indictment is voluntarily dismissed by the prosecution. In fine, there must have been a valid and sufficient complaint or information in the former prosecution. If therefore the complaint or information was insufficient because it was so defective in form or substance that the conviction upon it could not have been sustained, its dismissal without the consent of the accused cannot be pleaded. Thus, if the fiscal had no authority to file the information, the dismissal of the first information would not be a bar to accused subsequent prosecution. When the two offenses are different, the prohibition against double jeopardy refers to the same offense, not to the same act. The offense charged in the two prosecutions must be the same in law and in fact. Where the same act constitutes violations of two or more penal laws, prosecution under one such penal law will not bar prosecution in the other law. Hence, there is no jeopardy where the former offense is malum prohibitum, where the criminal intent of the accused is not necessarily for conviction, while the second is malum in se, where the criminal intent of the accused is an additional element for conviction. So conviction for the crime of illegal recruitment under the Labor Code does not preclude punishment under other statutes if some other crimes or felonies are committed in the process, such as the crime of estafa. When the case is dismissed on preliminary investigation, by reason of the abbreviated nature of preliminary investigations, a dismissal of the charges as a result thereof is not equivalent to a judicial pronouncement of acquittal. A converso, the finding of a prima facie case to hold the accused for trial is not equivalent to a finding of guilt. Hence, it does not place in jeopardy the person against whom it is taken. Section 8, provisional dismissal. A case shall not be provisionally dismissed except with the express consent of the accused and with notice to the offended party. The provisional dismissal of offenses punishable by imprisonment not exceeding 6 years or a fine of any amount or both shall become permanent 1 year after issuance of the order without the case having been revived. With respect to offenses punishable by imprisonment of more than 6 years, the provisional dismissal shall become permanent 2 years after issuance of the order without the case having been revived. This is a new provision based on decisions of the Supreme Court. In the case of People versus Tagle, People versus Obsania, and Vega Fria versus Castaneda. Provisional dismissal defined. Provisional dismissal may be defined as the dismissal of a criminal action with the express consent of the accused and without prejudice to its revival within the period prescribed by the rules. Requisites of provisional dismissal. The requisites of a provisional dismissal are the following. Number one, the accused must have given his express consent to the dismissal. Number two, there must be notice to the offended party. And number three, the dismissal must be without prejudice to its revival. When provisional dismissal becomes permanent, the provisional dismissal of offenses punishable by imprisonment not exceeding 6 years or a fine of any amount or both shall become permanent 1 year after issuance of the order without the case having been revived. With respect to offenses punishable by imprisonment of more than 6 years, their provisional dismissal shall become permanent 2 years after issuance of the order without the case having been revived. But if the dismissal is made without notice to the offended party, the reglementary period does not begin to run. The effect of the permanency of the dismissal is to bar the refiling or revival of the criminal action as well as the prosecution of the accused for the offense charge or for any attempt to commit the same or frustration thereof or for any offense which necessarily includes or is necessarily included in the offense charge in the former complaint or information. When dismissal has the effect of acquittal, double jeopardy will apply even if the dismissal is made with the express consent of the accused or upon his own motion, only if it is predicated on either of the two grounds, insufficiency of the evidence or denial of the right to speedy trial. In both cases, a dismissal will have the effect of an acquittal. Thus, in some cases in which the prosecution was not ready for a trial since the complainant and or his witnesses did not appear at the trial and the prosecution sought postponement of the trial on two or more occasions, it was held that the dismissals are equivalent to an acquittal even if they were made at the instance and with the consent of the accused. Such dismissals were predicated on the right of the accused to speedy trial. Section 9, failure to move to quash or to allege any ground therefore. The failure of the accused to assert any ground of a motion to quash before he pleads to the complaint or information, either because he did not file a motion to quash or failed to allege the same in said motion, shall be deemed a waiver of any objections except those based on the ground provided for in paragraphs A, B, G, and I of Section 3 of this rule. Annotations. This rule adopts the omnibus motion rule. Effects of failure to quash. The rule is that at any time before entering his plea, the accused may move to quash the complaint or information on the ground set forth in Section 3 of this rule. The following are the effects of the accused failure to file a motion to quash the complaint or information, viz. The ground for quashing the information is waived. The failure of the accused to assert any ground for a motion to quash before he pleads to the information, either because he did not file a motion to quash or failed to allege the same in said motion, shall be deemed a waiver of the grounds for a motion to quash except the grounds of no offense charge, lack of jurisdiction over the offense charge, extinction of the offense or penalty, double jeopardy, and lack of authority of the officer filing the information. Thus, the Supreme Court has ruled on several occasions that any objection involving a warrant of arrest or the procedure in the acquisition by the court of jurisdiction over the person of an accused must be made before he enters his plea, otherwise the objection is deemed waived. Thus, lack of jurisdiction over the person of an accused as a result of an invalid arrest must be raised through a motion to quash before an accused enters his plea. Otherwise, the objection is deemed waived and an accused is stopped from questioning the legality of his arrest. In a case in which the appellants were arrested, a case was filed against them. They pleaded not guilty upon arraignment, participated in the trial, and presented their respective evidence. It was held that it is too late for appellants to raise the question of their arrest on appeal. Appellants are thus stopped from questioning the legality of their arrest because appellants should have moved for the quashal of the information before the trial court on this ground. Accordingly, any irregularity in their arrest was cured when they voluntarily submitted themselves to the jurisdiction of the trial court. The right to object to evidence is waived. The failure to move for specifications or the quashal of the information on any of the grounds provided for in the rules of court deprives accused of the right to object to evidence which could be lawfully introduced and admitted under an information of more or less general terms, but which sufficiently charges the accused with a definite crime. However, it was held that a waiver of an illegal warrantless arrest does not also mean a waiver of the inadmissibility of evidence seized during an illegal warrantless arrest. Grounds not waived by failure to quash. The following grounds for a motion to quash are not waived despite the failure of the accused to raise the same before entering his plea, namely letter A, that the fact charged do not constitute an offense, B, that the court trying the case has no jurisdiction over the offense charged, C, that the criminal action or liability has been extinguished, D, that the accused has been previously convicted or acquitted of the offense charged, or the case against him was dismissed or otherwise terminated without his express consent, and E, that the officer who filed the information has no authority to do so. Thus, even if a party fails to file a motion to quash, he may still question the jurisdiction of the court later on based on the foregoing grounds. Moreover, these objections may be raised or considered motu proprio by the court at any stage of the proceedings or on appeal.